the paper's called The Pornographic, the Erotic and the Charming. It should really have been called The Pornographic, the Erotic, the Sublime and the Charming. And then I could have given you a nice crack about moving from the ridiculous to the sublime. But then I'd have had to make it clear I was talking about the content of some of these websites and not about... So I won't do any of that.
Which you've just successfully done.
Clever. The paper's very much... Schopenhauer exegesis, I'm afraid, but I hope I've tried to make a bit explicit the way some of what I take Schopenhauer to be getting at here connects with some of the themes that we've been talking about, and in particular some of the ideas of Jerry's that in the paper that we've been talking about for the last couple of days. Schopenhauer's brief discussion of the charming, as he calls it, his term in German is das Reizende, which his main translators translate as the charming or attractive. Occasionally it's translated as the stimulating, and it seems to me it might be better than any of those described as the seductive. But Schopenhauer's own, or in the main translation, the term that's given is the charming, and so I'll stick with that for the paper. A brief discussion of the charming in section 40 of the first volume of The World as Will and Representation, and here we have the locus of what are sometimes taken to be among the most risible of the claims in his philosophy of art. A species of the charming, he suggests, and now I'm quoting, is found in the still life painting of the Dutch, when they err by depicting edible objects. By their deceptive appearance, these necessarily excite the appetite, and this is just a stimulation of the will, which puts an end to any aesthetic contemplation of the object. Painted fruit, however, is admissible, for it exhibits itself as a further development of the flower, and as a beautiful product of nature through form and colour, without our being positively forced to think of its edibility. But unfortunately, we often find depicted with deceptive naturalness prepared and served up dishes, oysters, herrings, crabs, bread and butter, beer, wine, and so on, all of which is wholly objectionable. In historical painting and in sculpture, the charming consists in nude figures, the position, semi-drapery, and whole treatment of which are calculated to excite lustful feelings in the beholder. Purely aesthetic contemplation is at once abolished and the purpose of art thus defeated. End of quote. My purpose in what follows is twofold, to try to say something about the place of the charming in Schopenhauer's aesthetic theory, and to say something about the implications of this with respect to a distinction between pornography and erotica. Let me begin, though, by putting the remarks I've just quoted in context, by recalling the basic elements of Schopenhauer's aesthetic theory, for those of you who don't know it well. Schopenhauer introduces the theory in the opening section of Book 3 of The World as Will and Representation by rehearsing a number of themes that he's introduced in the first two books. The obverse, so to speak, of the phenomenal world is will. The innermost essence, as he says, the kernel of every particular thing and also of the whole. Will is manifest or objectified, it's the Kantian noumena, manifest or objectified in the phenomenal world at various grades or in varying degrees of clarity. As he says, its passage into visibility, its objectifications, has gradations as endless as those between the feeblest twilight and the brightest sunlight, the loudest tone and the softest echo. And the patterns of will's objectification in phenomena are the, as Schopenhauer insists, platonic ideas, what he calls the eternal forms of things. In short, individual phenomena in Schopenhauer's metaphysics are all objectifications at one grade or another of will. The ideas are the universal forms to which particular kinds of individual, phenomena instantiate. Aesthetic experience, as Schopenhauer understands it, is essentially experience in which a subject apprehends or has intuitive knowledge of these ideas. To experience has apprehends or has intuitive knowledge of the ideas. To experience an aspect of the natural world aesthetically is to experience it in such a way that, quote, we recognize in the object not the individual thing, but an idea. This is his version of the thought, familiar in the history of aesthetic theory, that aesthetic experience involves the transcendence of the particular and gives us access to the universal. Experience of this sort, as Schopenhauer construes it, depends on a distinctive mode of cognition. Everyday cognition is structured by the forms of the principle of sufficient reason, he says, namely space, time, and causality. Structured, that is, in such a way as to make it of practical use in meeting the individual's needs and desires. So the way I cognize the world is in terms of spatial and temporal relationships that things have to me, so I can decide whether to run away from them or eat them or what have you. The ideas, however, as he says, do not enter into the principle of sufficient reason. Neither plurality nor change, he says, belongs to them. Which is to say that the ideas don't exist in time and space and can't be grasped in terms of spatial, temporal, or causal relations. It follows that the ideas can't be objects of knowledge by means of everyday cognition. However, Schopenhauer maintains that cognition which is not structured by the forms of the principle of sufficient reason is, as an exception, possible for human beings. Such cognition occurs, and knowledge of the ideas becomes possible, when the individual's natural functioning as a servant, so to speak, of the individual's will is suspended. When cognition is not driven, that is to say, by desire and emotion, such that, quote, we forget our individuality, our will, and continue to exist only as pure subject. In short, Schopenhauer emphasizes time and time again that the hallmark of aesthetic experience is its willlessness. This is his take, again, on the familiar thought that aesthetic experience is to be defined in terms of disinterestedness. Again, then, as Schopenhauer has it, to experience something aesthetically is to experience it in such a way that, quote, we recognize in the object not the individual thing, but an idea. And since everything is such that it can, in principle, be perceived as an expression of the idea that it instantiates, he suggests everything is also beautiful. This claim may call to mind the position in environmental aesthetics labelled positive aesthetics that holds that everything in untouched, pristine nature has only or primarily positive aesthetic qualities. But it in fact reflects a much older, one might say the traditional, conception of beauty as, roughly, the formal object of aesthetic experience. In this sense of beauty, then, being a potential object of aesthetic experience, which everything is, according to Schopenhauer, is a sufficient condition of being beautiful. However, Schopenhauer also uses the term beauty in a second sense, one that reflects the thought that aesthetic experience is not solely a matter of the experience of beauty. In this latter sense of the term, being a potential object of aesthetic experience is merely a necessary and not a sufficient condition of being beautiful. Things that are beautiful in this sense, that is, constitute a subset of things that are beautiful in the first sense. The beautiful in this second sense represents one, but not the only category of potential objects of aesthetic experience. The other category, and as Schopenhauer sets things up in his aesthetic theory, it appears to be the only other category of aesthetic experience that he acknowledges, is that of the sublime, a topic to which we'll return. So much then for background. What now of the charming? Schopenhauer introduces the notion as the opposite of the sublime, and the contrast that he appears to have in mind is that while the opposite is his term of the sublime, and the contrast that he appears to have in mind is that while the latter is a category of objects of aesthetic experience, the former, the charming, is not only non-aesthetic, so to speak, but positively anti-aesthetic. The charming, he stipulates, is that which excites the will by directly presenting to it satisfaction or fulfillment. And as such, quote, it draws the beholder down from pure contemplation, demanded by every apprehension of the beautiful, since it necessarily stirs his will by objects which directly appeal to it. Thus, the beholder no longer remains pure subject of knowing, but becomes the needy and dependent subject of willing. End of quote. It follows then that the charming is not a fit subject for art, the proper purpose of which, as Schopenhauer understands it, is to facilitate willless contemplation of the ideas. Where he finds species of the charming in the province of art, in the Dutch still life painting and the historical painting and sculpture that he refers to in the quotation that I began with, He regards them as, quote, unworthy of the context. As he says, the charming is everywhere to be avoided in art. Thus far, it looks as though the charming, like the sublime, labels a category of objects of experience, but a category of objects unlike those of the sublime that cannot be experienced aesthetically. As Schopenhauer goes on, however, it becomes clear that in the charming, he has in mind not so much a category of objects or experience as a concept of art criticism. Everything he goes on to say about the matter suggests that charmingness, for want of a better term, is a manner or style of representation or depiction. The Dutch still life painters to whom he refers err, as Schopenhauer sees it, not simply in depicting prepared and served up dishes, but in depicting them with, as he says, deceptive naturalness, or in a manner that necessarily excites the appetite, such that the spectator is positively forced to think of their edibility. And the historical painters and sculptures err not in virtue of depicting nude figures. The ancients, after all, did so, as Schopenhauer says, almost always free from fault, but rather in their treatment of those figures, in ways, quote, calculated to excite lustful feeling in the beholder and in the spirit of base subjective sensuality. As Schopenhauer presents it, in short, the charming refers not to a category of objects or experience, but to a manner or set of styles of depiction that is or are likely, if not calculated, to excite the will in such a way as to make will-less aesthetic experience impossible. And again, given that the function of art is to facilitate will-less aesthetic experience, the charming is everywhere to be avoided in art. Now, at this point, one might ask how, if the charming refers to modes or manners of depiction, it could be supposed to be the opposite, as Schopenhauer has it, of the sublime, which he takes to be a category of objects of aesthetic experience. I'll come back to this. For the moment, however, let's pause for a tiny bit longer. I'm having real trouble with one of my contact lenses. Losing my space on the page.
Pause for an interested activity.
Sorry, I hope it doesn't bother any of you seeing people do their... Completely freaks my kids out, the idea of people touching their eyes. Okay, so the question was, you know, if the sublime is a category or a set of styles of depiction, in what sense could it be thought to be the opposite of a category of aesthetic experience? It just looks like a different sort of thing. I'll come back to this, but for the moment, let's pause to reflect on his remarks about nude figures. As we've seen, Schopenhauer distinguishes between representations in which nudity is treated in ways calculated to excite lustful feeling in the beholder, in the spirit of subjective base sensuality, and representations of nudity that, quote, the artist himself created with a purely objective spirit filled with ideal beauty. And it's hard not to see in this the beginnings, at least, of a distinction between pornographic and erotic representation, or at least a distinction that echoes some of the intuitions that underlie some recent attempts to distinguish between pornography and erotica. So, first, I take it to be uncontroversial, even now, at a minimum, that pornography is representation that, through the depiction of material that appeals to the sexual instincts of the consumer, is designed to excite sexually. And to make money, as Susan has pointed out. Representations of this sort, things that are designed to appeal to the sexual instincts of the consumer, seem to be just what Schopenhauer has in mind in his reference to painting and sculpture in which nudity is treated in a way, quote, calculated to excite lustful feeling in the beholder. Thus, there seems to be at least a very large overlap between what Schopenhauer refers to as the charming and what's plausibly understood as the pornographic, or between what Schopenhauer refers to as presented charmingly and what's plausibly understood as the pornographic. Second, pornography, even thus minimally characterized, is bound to be problematic or seen as problematic along at least two dimensions. Given a certain cultural, or perhaps more accurately, religious backdrop, it's bound to be seen as worrying, doubtless in a number of ways, from a moral point of view. And against the backdrop of a certain tradition of aesthetic theory, one that emphasises, relatedly, the disinterestedness of aesthetic experience and the non-instrumentality of works of art, it's bound to be worrying in the context of the philosophy of art. And in this respect, Schopenhauer's suggestion that, quote, the charming is everywhere to be avoided in art, echoes the view, or at least seems to echo the view, of a number of commentators, including Jerry, that the pornographic and the artistic are not combinable. Third, one way of understanding the genesis of the concept of erotica, if only as an heuristic device, is in terms of the fact that in response to these and related worries about pornography, it will inevitably be noted that not all representations that are designed to appeal to the sexual instincts are in virtue of that morally worrying, and that some representations that are designed to appeal to the sexual instincts can, despite, if not indeed partly in virtue of that, be works of art. Erotica, then, emerges as the category of representations that depict material that appeals to the sexual instincts of the consumer, but that are nonetheless, to use shorthand, respectable, not least in being morally acceptable and capable of constituting art. But how far is this very minimal, and I take it to be, you know, a very minimal characterization of erotica, congruent with Schopenhauer's characterization of that with which he contrasts representation that is charming and, as I have characterized it, pornographic? Not, on the face of it, very far at all. The representations of nudity that he regards as free from fault are those that have been created, as he says, with a purely objective spirit. Indeed, anything that is genuine or successful art, anything that fulfills the function of art, is created in such a spirit. And what he means by created with a purely objective spirit is roughly created to express a purely objective vision, a vision untainted by subjectivity of what is represented, a vision that is made possible by the abolition of individuality, by a mode of cognition that is free from the influence of desire and emotion, in which the intellect is broken free from the demands of the will. Once we have, as he says, given ourselves up to pure will-less knowing, we have stepped into another world, so to speak, where everything that moves our will and thus violently agitates us no longer exists. That's aesthetic experience. So, as we saw earlier, aesthetic experience is supposed by Schopenhauer to be will-less experience. If erotica depicts material that appeals to the sexual and very much willful instincts of the consumer, then it would seem that Schopenhauer has no room for the idea that erotica could be experienced aesthetically or could be art. And that is to say, in effect, it would seem that Schopenhauer has no room for the idea of erotica, as I characterized it a moment ago, at all. Now, this may seem uncontroversial, an obvious concomitant of Schopenhauer's take on disinterestedness. Nonetheless, I suggest that to draw this conclusion would be a mistake, and establishing this will be my main concern in the rest of the paper. To return to the question I asked a moment ago, given that Schopenhauer regards the charming as a mode or manner of depiction, in what sense can it be the opposite of the sublime, which he takes to be a category of objects of aesthetic experience? The short answer is that in terms of what Schopenhauer actually says about the charming, there's very little, if any, sense in the suggestion that it's the opposite of the sublime. But there's more to be said, and indeed more that he should have said than Schopenhauer does say about the charming. And recognising what that is will allow us to see that both that there is an important sense in which something like the charming is indeed opposite, or at least parallel, to the sublime, and that there is, in fact, conceptual room for the notion of erotic art in Schopenhauer's aesthetic theory. First, however, we need to return to the sublime and the beautiful. Schopenhauer distinguishes between the sublime and the beautiful in terms of the readiness with which the transition from normal, everyday, will-driven cognition to disinterested, aesthetic, will-less contemplation comes about in a subject on a given occasion. This, he suggests, will depend in part on how pressing the demands of the subject's will are on that occasion, and the latter will in turn depend in part upon the nature of the objects of perception on that occasion. Beautiful objects, Schopenhauer holds, in effect just stipulates, are those that accommodate, as he says, the transition from the, into the state of willlessness in a perceiver. Such objects, beautiful objects, easily become representatives of their ideas, inasmuch as the perception of them does not provoke activity of will. So there's a kind of passive experience. Aesthetic experience is a kind of completely passive slide from normal, everyday, will-driven cognition, where you're going about sort of pursuing your desires and driven by emotion. Come across a beautiful object and it, as it were, sucks you into willless aesthetic experience. Sublime objects or states of affairs, by contrast, stand in, quote, a hostile relation to the human will in general, as manifested in the human body. They may be opposed to it, they may threaten it by their might that eliminates all resistance, or their immeasurable greatness may reduce it to naught. Sounds like Kant, and it's meant to be an echo of Kant. Sublime objects and states of affairs, that is, are recognized by the object as threatening in one sense or another, and that recognition is an impediment to transition into willless contemplation of them. Despite this, Schopenhauer insists, such contemplation of the sublime is possible. Quote, nevertheless, the beholder may not direct his attention to this relation to his will which is so pressing and hostile, but although he perceives it and acknowledges it, he may consciously turn away from it, forcibly tear himself from his will and its relations, and, giving himself up entirely to knowledge, may quietly contemplate, as pure willless subject of knowing, those very objects so terrible to the will. He may comprehend only their idea that is foreign to all relation, gladly linger over its contemplation, and consequently be elevated precisely in this way above himself, his person, his willing, and all willing. In that case, he's then filled with the feeling of the sublime, and the object that causes such a state is called sublime. So the difference between the sublime and the beautiful is fundamentally, though not wholly, to be understood in terms of their causal backgrounds. As he says, thus what distinguishes the feeling of the sublime from that of the beautiful is that with the beautiful, pure knowledge has, or willlessness has gained the upper hand without a struggle. On the other hand, with the sublime, that state of pure knowing is obtained first of all by a conscious and violent tearing away from the relations of the object to the will, which are recognized as unfavorable. Now, in light of this, it's hard to see why Schopenhauer doesn't acknowledge a third category of experience, of aesthetic experience, one that, in fact, parallels that of the sublime. Given that a hostile relation to the will, as he says, can be turned away from or forcibly torn from, allowing objects that stand in such a relation to be experienced aesthetically, all of which Schopenhauer holds to be the case with regard to the sublime, there seems no reason at all to suppose that a relation of attraction between objects that directly appeal and the will to which they appeal is not in principle similarly turnable away or forcibly tearable from, allowing those objects to be experienced aesthetically. That is, there's no reason, so far as I can see, why Schopenhauer should not have said of certain sorts of object, and now I'm just going to paraphrase very closely the passage I quoted a moment ago on the sublime, nevertheless, the beholder may not direct his attention to this relation to his will which is so appealing and seductive, but although he perceives it and acknowledges it, he may consciously turn away from it, forcibly tear himself from his will and his relations, and giving himself up entirely to knowledge, may quietly contemplate, as pure willless subject of knowing, those very objects so attractive to the will. He may comprehend only their idea that is foreign to all relation, gladly linger over its contemplation, and consequently be elevated in this way above himself, his person, his willing and all willing. In that case, he is then filled with the feeling of the charming, and therefore the object that causes such a state is called charming. I say there's no reason that I can see why Schopenhauer shouldn't have said something like this, and indeed there's every reason to think that Schopenhauer should have said something like this. After all, if every existing thing is beautiful, as he claims, that is, if everything is such that it can in principle be perceived as an expression of the idea that it instantiates, that must include those things that have a relation of attractiveness or attraction or seductiveness to the human will. My suggestion is, then, that Schopenhauer should have recognised a third category of aesthetic experience. Just as terrifying objects and situations may be willlessly experienced as sublime, if the subject is able to turn her attention away from the hostile relation in which those objects stand to the human will in general, as it's manifested in the human body, so, he ought to have acknowledged, attractive objects may be willlessly experienced if a subject is able to turn his attention away from the relation of attraction that those objects stand in to human willing. Willlessly experienced as what, however? We just don't have a clear, settled terminology here. In my paraphrase a moment ago, I took the analogue of the sublime to be the charming. But it probably makes more sense, and it's certainly closer to Schopenhauer's own use of the term, to think of the charming as analogous to the terrifying. So just as you've got terrifying objects, and through a certain act of will, they can be experienced as sublime, you've got charming, attractive objects, which through an act of will can be experienced as, well, what? The fact is, we simply don't have a single term here that corresponds to the sublime. That is, a single term for a variety of disinterested aesthetic experience that depends on, in some sense, turning away from the seductiveness of an object or situation. But that's not to say, however, that we don't recognise that there are kinds of aesthetic experience that have this character. For example, in some of their uses in the history of aesthetics, the notion of the delightful, and indeed that of the picturesque, have both been used to label objects of aesthetic experience of this variety. And so, I suggest, has the notion of the erotic. Consider, for example, Jerry's thought that erotica is to be distinguished from pornography partly in terms of the fact that the former is designed to stimulate sexually, the latter to arouse in the interests of what Jerry delicately refers to as sexual release, or what I now prefer to think of as assuagement. For a work of erotic art to succeed as an object of aesthetic appreciation, where this is understood to entail some degree of willlessness, Jerry argues, stimulation and arousal have to be held in check. His thought, I take it, is that they have to be held in check by the work, but perhaps, and particularly if we go beyond erotic art to cases in which the aesthetic appreciation in question is of, as it were, a natural phenomenon, such as another person's body, it may also have to be held in check by the appreciator. In Schopenhauerian terms, the sexual allure of the object, or the seductiveness of the object, will have to be turned away from. But that putting of Jerry's point in Schopenhauerian terms, as I said, is of course far too quick. To continue the quotation that I started a moment ago, in the aesthetic experience of erotic art, Jerry suggests, quote, stimulation and arousal have to be held in check, neither suppressed nor given completely free rein. If it's given completely free rein, I take his point to be, stimulation will turn into full-blooded, if I can put it like that, arousal, and the possibility of disinterestedness and hence of genuinely aesthetic experience will evaporate. If stimulation is entirely suppressed, however, and again I take something like this at any rate to be Jerry's point, the experience will be, as it were, point missing. If the object in question does, in fact, and is designed to appeal to the sexual instincts, then a response that involves the suppression of stimulation will simply not be adequate to the object. It won't be a response to it as it really is, or for what it really is, or for its own sake, and so on and so forth. And this doesn't sound much like aesthetic experience either. But isn't the complete suppression of stimulation a condition of the possibility of aesthetic experience, as Schopenhauer construes the latter, that is, as purely objective, as free from the influence of desire or emotion, as experience in which everything that moves our will and thus violently agitates us no longer exists? One might say that Jerry owes us more by way of an account of how stimulation, even stimulation held in check, is consistent with disinterestedness. But however tricky that might be to come up with, showing that stimulation to any degree is consistent with Schopenhauerian willlessness looks simply impossible. If erotic experience or an adequate response to erotica essentially involves stimulation, as I take Jerry to be suggesting, which seems to be right, then, as I suggested earlier, it looks very much as though Schopenhauer has no room for the idea that erotica could be experienced aesthetically, or that there could be such a thing as erotic art. Before we accept this, however, we should notice that an analogous problem arises for Schopenhauer with regard to the sublime. For the sublime, which in the century or so before Schopenhauer started thinking about these matters had emerged as a fully fledged category of aesthetic experience, was, indeed is, I think, standardly understood as a variety of experience in which pleasure is alloyed with one or another kind of uneasiness, in which the object of experience is perceived as in some sense disturbing or threatening or challenging. The feeling of the sublime is, as Addison says, an agreeable kind of horror. It's, as John Dennis put it, an enthusiastic terror. And as Burke says, its strongest emotion is an emotion of distress. But horror, terror, distress, indeed all such forms of uneasiness, are in Schopenhauerian terms modifications or affectations of the individual will. If this sort of feeling is at the heart of the experience of experience of the sublime, then, assuming that Schopenhauer is really entitled to the sublime as a variety of aesthetic experience, there had better be a Schopenhauerian account of how the experience of uneasiness is consistent with willless experience. And if such an account is available, then there may be a parallel account of how stimulation is consistent with willless experience. So, the problem that we're faced with can be expressed with respect to both the sublime and the erotic as what looks like a reductio. From the premises, one, aesthetic experience is fundamentally willless. Two, the sublime and the erotic are categories of aesthetic experience. Three, experience of the sublime and the erotic essentially involve uneasiness or stimulation. And four, feelings of uneasiness slash stimulation are in one way or another affectations of the will. We can derive the apparently absurd conclusion, five, that the state of willlessness may involve affectations of the will. At least one of the premises will have to go, it would seem, but, take it from me, it's not clear that any of them can be rejected without doing considerable damage to either or both the plausibility and the consistency of Schopenhauer's aesthetic theory. Having said that, however, is it so clear that the conclusion of our supposed reductio, the conclusion that a state of willlessness may involve affectations of the will, is indeed absurd? Schopenhauer emphasizes, after all, that intuitive knowledge of the ideas, which is what he says is given in aesthetic experience, is given through sensation. As he says at one point, knowledge of the idea is necessarily knowledge through perception. That is to say, as Schopenhauer construes it, aesthetic experience is essentially embodied experience. How this is supposed to apply to the experience of literature is an interesting question, but it is nonetheless Schopenhauer's position. Given that an individual's body is nothing other than the objectification of his will, and that sensation involves modification, or, as he says, stimulation of the body, surely it follows that willless cognition of the ideas must not only be consistent with, but actually depends on, modification of the will. What then can Schopenhauer mean by willlessness? What can willless knowing amount to, given that it cannot literally depend on the absence of will or on the will's being unmoved or unaffected? The answer can only be, I suggest, that willless knowing is a kind of cognition in which intellect is not operating in the service of the will. Aesthetic experience involves not so much will-less cognition, that is, as cognition that is not, so to speak, driven by the demands of the individual's will, not driven, that is to say, by desire and emotion. Schopenhauer's tendency to describe this variety of experience in terms of willlessness may be explicable in terms of the fact that his main concern, of course, is with the experience of beauty, experience in which, because of the nature of the kinds of object in question, the subject is not conscious of himself as a phenomenal will, as a phenomenon of will, experience in which the will has been, as he says, forgotten. But lack of consciousness of one's will doesn't entail the absence of will or of willing. And more importantly, for our purposes here, it's far from clear that lack of consciousness of the individual will, which is to say of desires and emotions, is a necessary concomitant of cognitive experience that's not driven by the individual will. Nothing that Schopenhauer says rules out the possibility that non-will-driven experience may be experience in which one is aware of one's will and, for that matter, of acts of willing. All that his general conception of aesthetic experience rules out general conception of aesthetic experience rules out in this regard is that in such experience one's cognition or intellect could be driven by or functioning in the service of the will. How However, even if it's true that, as Schopenhauer understands it, will-less aesthetic experience may be continuous with awareness of oneself as a willing being, does this establish that there is conceptual room in his aesthetic theory for aesthetic experience that is uneasy, in the case of the sublime, or stimulating, in the case of erotica? Well, it's clear that some species, indeed the main species of uneasiness and stimulation, are not compatible with willlessness in the sense characterized above. As Schopenhauer says, quote, "If a single individual willing, such as fear or desire, were to enter consciousness, the individual will, thus actually affected, would at once gain the upper hand. The peace of contemplation, i.e. aesthetic experience, would become impossible." But the uneasiness or stimulation of passion or emotion and desire, while it may be the most prevalent variety of uneasiness or stimulation, is not the only variety. Schopenhauer emphasizes at a number of points that experience of the sublime involves exaltation, his term, Erhaben. With the sublime, he says, that state of pure knowing is obtained first of all by a conscious and violent tearing away from the relations of the object to the will which are recognized as unfavorable, by a free exaltation accompanied by consciousness beyond the will and the knowledge related to it. And he goes on to maintain that in experience of the sublime, in contrast with the experience of beauty, quote, exaltation must not only be one with consciousness, but also be maintained, and it's therefore accompanied by a constant recollection of the will, yet not of a single individual willing, such as fear of desire, but of human willing in general, insofar as it is expressed universally in the human body. Now, this sentence is both, it seems to me anyway, suggestive and puzzling. On the one hand, it hints in the references to maintenance and a constant recollection of the will at potential sources of uneasiness and perhaps indeed of stimulation that may be elements in willless experience. On the other hand, it's very far from obvious why Schopenhauer regards exaltation, or as he sometimes calls it, elevation, as needing to be maintained in the experience of the sublime, why and in what sense it is therefore accompanied by a constant recollection of will, and what a recollection of human willing in general might so much as amount to. Schopenhauer's own discussion of the matter is so sketchy that it's difficult to settle these questions decisively. Well, that's very modest. I, of course, think I have settled these questions decisively. The reading of his position that makes most sense of what he does say, I think, is as follows. When an object or situation is perceived as, even if only potentially, hostile or threatening, the possibility of experiencing it aesthetically depends on the subject's freely or consciously disregarding any threat that it may appear to pose to him. But this does not entail that the subject stops perceiving the object of perception as by nature threatening. By hypothesis, it is threatening, and a subject who loses sight of that fact would therefore not be seeing the object for what it really is. In Schopenhauerian terms, would not be perceiving its ideas, and hence would not be experiencing it aesthetically at all. In short, then, the subject of aesthetic experience of the sublime has to recognize the object of his perception as threatening without experiencing it as a threat to him. And this is what Schopenhauer's getting at when he says that experience of the sublime involves a constant recollection of human willing in general. The subject recognizes the object, or the kind of thing that the object represents, as in some sense opposed to human beings in general, but does not focus on the object's relation to him as an individual. However, given that the natural function of intellect, the cognitive capacity, is to further the ends of the individual will, so that the, as it were, default operating mode of intellect is in service of that will, the fact that a subject recognizes an object as threatening, even in this general sense, means that there will be a continuing pull towards the apprehension of that object as an individual in terms of its hostile relation to the individual subject. A tendency, that is, to slide from apprehending it as a threatening kind of thing to seeing it as an actual threat to oneself. Sublime experience, that is in an important respect, essentially unstable. And in this respect, sublime experience, as I take Schopenhauer to construe it, is somewhat analogous to the visual experience of an apparently three-dimensional image in the two-dimensional patterns of an autostereogram, or so-called magic eye picture. In such cases, coming to have the visual experience involves some effort or struggle, as is the case with experience of the sublime, and once one does have it, the experience often feels, and indeed is, unstable and liable to slip out of one's grasp. Turn away and it's gone, as it were. This, then, is the sense in which willless experience of the sublime requires maintenance. More precisely, this kind of experience depends on the subject's maintaining focus on the relations of the idea instantiated by the object in question to human willing in general, without sliding back into perception of it as an individual thing that is potentially or actually threatening to the individual perceiver or subject. Hence Schopenhauer's suggestion that it's because the state of exaltation needs to be maintained that it is, therefore, accompanied by a constant recollection of human willing in general. Without a focus on the latter, aesthetic experience of the sublime will just be impossible. Willless cognition, if it's been obtained at all, will simply collapse back into fear. The object will stop being experienced as sublime and will now just be experienced as terrifying. Now, it would take much more time than I, let alone any of you, have here to give a detailed defence of this understanding of Schopenhauer's take on the sublime. And in any case, doing so would take us much too far from our topic. So, let's just assume that something like what I've just said is right. The question is, can a similar line be run with regard to the erotic, to give a Schopenhauerian account of the latter? I don't see why not. The line will go, roughly at any rate, as follows. When something is perceived as sexually alluring, the possibility of experiencing it aesthetically depends on the subject's deliberately disregarding its allure to him. But this does not entail that the subject stops perceiving the object of perception as by nature threatening, stimulating or alluring. By hypothesis, after all, it is stimulating, and a subject who loses sight of that fact would therefore not be seeing the object for what it really is, in Schopenhauerian terms would not be perceiving the object, the idea that it instantiates, and hence would not be aesthetically experiencing it at all. In short, then, the subject of aesthetic experience of the erotic recognizes, this is my Schopenhauerian reading of it, will recognize the object of his perception as stimulating, or it's in some sense alluring to human willing as a species, or to will as it manifests itself in human beings in general, but does not focus on the object's relation to him as an individual. Stimulation, in short, will have been held in check. But doesn't stimulation held in check now simply mean, in effect, stimulation stopped off at the pass, stimulation suppressed? Isn't experience of the erotic, as I have reconstructed it for Schopenhauer, just too bloodless to be recognisable as genuinely of the erotic? I think not. For on my reconstruction, experience of the Schopenhauerian erotic, if I can put it like that, shares what I have argued is an essential feature of the Schopenhauerian sublime, namely instability. I said a moment ago that since, as Schopenhauer understands it, the natural function of intellect is to further the ends of the individual will, the fact that a subject recognizes an object as in some sense opposed to human willing in general means that there will be a continual pull towards the apprehension of that object as an individual in terms of its hostile relation to the individual subject, a tendency that is to slide from apprehending it as a threatening kind of thing to seeing it as a threat to oneself. And the same will be true where a subject recognizes an object as alluring to human willing in general. There will be a tendency to slide from apprehending it as an alluring or seductive kind of thing to experiencing it as arousing. Maintaining an aesthetic experience of the object does indeed demand resisting the slide. But the continuing pull towards that slide means that aesthetic experience of the erotic is likely to be experienced as very far from bloodless. It's likely to be experienced, I think, on a spectrum between mildly tense and extraordinarily difficult. If I thought in advance, I'd have bought my own collection of pictures by... any number, but the Schiele ones that Jerry showed yesterday seems to me to be particularly good at this. I mean, it seems to me that if you look at that painting and the ones that are like it, that is the right way to think about it. I mean, maybe this is just autobiography, but that is how I experience it. It does seem to me that an aesthetic experience of it is something that's kind of hard to hold on to because it is so gripping. And it seems to me there is, in the phenomenology of the experience, exactly what I've argued to be in the phenomenology of the experience of the sublime, as Schopenhauer understands it, a tendency to slide from disinterested objective perception into very much interested will-driven perception. So, the continuing pull towards that slide means that aesthetic experience of the erotic is likely to be experienced as far from bloodless, likely to be experienced on a spectrum between mildly tense and difficult. And that is to say, it will be one, again, in which stimulation is held in check. So what do I claim to have done here? With regard to Schopenhauer's scholarship, if that doesn't sound too pretentious, I hope to have shown that he ought to have acknowledged that there is conceptual room within his aesthetic theory for a category of aesthetic experience which parallels, even if it's not exactly opposite, that of the sublime. And I hope to have shown that the erotic fits within that category for Schopenhauer. But I hope too to have shown that the elements of Schopenhauer's aesthetic theory provide the basis against which the notion of stimulation held in check, as Jerry put it, a notion that still seems to me to be important in understanding the notions of erotic art, that notion can be found in Schopenhauer. Good, thank you.